of religious symbolism, which when I talked to him earlier, I had to have him explain to me, and I'm sure that it will become very clear as to what that means. I've known Jeff for a long time, and I'll tell you just a little bit about him and let him speak to you. He's married and has five children. Until fairly recently, he has been living in Northern California and has moved back to Utah and lives in American Fork. He is the general manager of Executone Telephone Systems and for some time has been a member of the Sunstone National Advisory Board. My name is Kurt Bench, by the way, and it's always a pleasure for a bench to chair a session at Sunstone. I think that's why they chose me. I've known Jeff as a rare book dealer. I've been selling books for a long time, and Jeff has been a good customer and is very fine-tuned in his collecting, although he doesn't collect too much anymore, but I still like him. And he's a good man, a very generous person, a good friend, and very knowledgeable on Mormon theology. And so I'll turn the time over to Jeff.
I found out when I started collecting rare books, or a little bit afterwards, that I don't know how fine-tuned it was. It's just that my likes were esoteric enough that I would pay 50 times what anyone else would pay for an item.
But not to me, however. But
not to yes. Kurt gave me the discount. My purpose in I struggled with this presentation because I'm not a historian and just a jailhouse theologian, but it's a subject that's important to me. An earlier version of this paper was presented nearly 2 years ago in California at Sunstone and was inspired by the Joseph Campbell, Bill Moyers interviews that were on PBS entitled The Power of Myth. Some of the references are to Campbell's general thinking and issues presented during these 6 half-hour programs. For this presentation, I have essentially integrated that previous paper into a parallel paper relating specifically to 4 general scenarios in which prophets, I believe, have historically dealt with the development of doctrine, ritual, and symbolism, and how or to what extent Joseph Smith dealt in all 4 arenas, thereby establishing him as a legitimate prophetic figure to usher in the dispensation of the fullness of times. The 4 broad areas are, and I made these areas up so no one can, basically, as I saw it, the situations that the prophets found themselves in was, 1, the preservation and renewal of previous doctrine and religious ritual. 2, was the reevaluation of existing doctrine and ritual. 3, is the appropriation of new symbolism or ritual to convey a new and existing doctrine or ritual. And 4, is the appropriation of new symbolism to house a new, previously unarticulated doctrine. I'm just going to skip over the first couple because I just put them in there to as kind of catch-all areas that probably would catch some scenarios the prophets found themselves in. The first one is the preservation and renewal of previous doctrine and religious ritual. We won't talk much about that, but basically this category, I would say, is characterized by what you would consider to be sort of the caretaker prophet, where the basic position of the prophetic discourse is to restate the current standard and renew a call for adherence to the present fundamentals. This occurs when a prophet restates his own position or takes the position that what is needed is not new revelation, but adherence to yet uncomplied with revelations. 2 is the reevaluation of existing doctrine and ritual. And I could find a lot, this is already too long a paper, but I could find and had found a lot of examples of these in the Old Testament, but to give you a modern example, President Kimball's ministry, where there were many substantive changes in the practice of the church, including the revelation on the priesthood, missionary and temple work, the organization of the 70, but were all of the substantive changes represented not new doctrine, but a rethinking of the status quo and a return to or a fulfillment of what could be considered basic tenets or expectations of previous ministries. So I would say that his ministry reflected an examination, say, of the Doctrine and Covenants and of those revelations and a conformity to those rather than something new and unheard of. The third and fourth ones we're really going to talk about. The third is the appropriation of new symbolism or ritual to convey a new and existing doctrine or ritual. And this is one that I believe has relevance to some of the changes in our ritual currently. Much like the situation we have just discussed, this situation calls not for the reevaluation of doctrine, but an actual update of ritual or symbolism to more faithfully portray the doctrines or practices involved to a new audience where existing symbols do not accurately or adequately represent the ideas which they were originally intended to represent. In these situations, it may seem to the audience that there has been a shift in doctrine or an emphasis, when in fact the shift may be a return to the original intent, or may portray that which is intended in a manner that is less confrontational, or may have fewer divergent meanings than those acquired over time by the existing symbols. I'll explain that in a little bit here. And the fourth one is the appropriation of new symbolism to house a new or previously unarticulated doctrine. Joseph Smith, particularly during the Nauvoo period, seems to have engaged in this type of enterprise more than any of the previous three. Initially, I think it could be held that Joseph Smith was involved in presenting familiar doctrines in familiar languages and forms. Due to his role as the first prophet of the dispensation, much of his doctrinal development beyond the initial, more traditional doctrine involved, section 124, things which have been kept hid from before the foundation of the world, things that pertain to the dispensation of the fullness of times. Joseph Smith is quoted as saying, "It is my meditation all the day, and more than my meat and drink, that I may know how to make the saints of God to comprehend the visions that flow like an overflowing surge before my mind." This statement, to me, implies not only that Joseph was not told specifically how to present the revelations to the people, in all cases, but that he was given some freedom in how he chose to present them. Perhaps Joseph did not relish this freedom always. It would have been presumably much easier and required much less meditation had God simply given the revelations verbatim in the precise language and form he intended Joseph to use. To quote Gerhard von Rad, "In Old Testament times, what determined the choice of the form was primarily the subject matter of the message, but the content of the prophetic preaching could not possibly be housed in any traditional form, not even a specifically prophetic, for it completely transcended the whole of Israel's previous knowledge of Yahweh. The very nature of the subject matter itself demanded nothing short of a bold method of expression. It was always, so to speak, ad hoc improvisation, simply because the prophet's message thrusts out at every side beyond each and all of Israel's sacral institutions. In the same way, the very nature of prophecy also demanded the right to make use of what were entirely secular forms with exactly the same freedom as with religious ones, as if there was no difference at all between them. For ultimately, prophecy moved in a direction which transcended the old distinctions." We're reminded of the statement of the Lord through Joseph Smith in 1830, "that all things unto me are spiritual," expressing the transcendency of the message which Joseph was delivering to the world and implicitly defining a broad playing field which not be encumbered by artificial boundaries between church and state or secular and religious institutions or forms. An important element in the revelations of Joseph Smith was the acknowledgement that all circumscribed into one great whole. To say that Joseph Smith did not use traditional forms does not mean that he used totally new forms, but that he used forms to represent that which they had not been previously used to represent, or at least not in the culture and context in which he was unveiling them. This discussion touches on the dynamics of revelation itself. How much freedom is a prophet given in his choice of forms and to clothe the revelations of God? Joseph's use of familiar forms and symbols from his environment may give rise to the notion that he was merely a product of his time and environment. A prophet never is so much a product of his environment as a bridge between his environment and a higher order. And that bridge is always constructed with new and more complex use of symbolism and myth. The importance and relevance of myth in our own lives is described in a statement by Joseph Campbell in one of these programs I was talking about. He said, Greek and Latin and biblical literature used to be part of everyone's education. Now, when these things were dropped, a whole tradition of mythological information was lost. It used to be that these stories were in the minds of people. When the story is on your mind, then you see its relevance to something happening in your own life. It gives you perspective on what's happening to you. These bits of information from ancient times, which have to do with the themes that have supported human life, built civilizations, and informed religions over the millennia, have to do with deep inner problems, inner mysteries, inner thresholds of passage, and if you don't know what the guide signs are along the way, you have to work it out for yourself. But once this subject catches you, you don't want to give it up. Unquote. It has been helpful to me personally to view the use of mythology and symbolism in the prophetic career of Joseph Smith in the context of his peers and predecessors, the ancient biblical prophets. Upon examination of these earlier prophets, I've been impressed at the manner in which they similarly dealt with symbolism in constructing and enhancing their own prophetic message. The purpose of this paper is to acknowledge a context and pattern for the appropriation, and by appropriation, obviously, I mean what some people would accuse the prophets of, just lifting it, stealing it from other cultures, and of religious traditions and symbolism by ancient prophets, to place Joseph Smith in that same context with examples of his use of appropriated symbolism, and then to consider what this may all mean to us today as we contemplate the value of symbolism in our own lives. Anciently, it was of the essence of a prophet to be rooted in the religious tradition. Without it, his office was inconceivable. Indeed, this was a much more real and fundamental issue for the prophets themselves than it was for their contemporaries. They used the most extraordinary means to convince their hearers of the binding force and undiminished validity of ordinances from which the hearers had long broken away and of which they were perhaps no longer aware. In this appeal to the old, uncorrupted traditions, the prophet's work had a thoroughgoing element of reformation. It is striking that the prophets are often very arbitrary as they bring the old material to bear on their own day. That is, they do not always do justice to its old form as they restate it, but apply it as they understand it. This often enough means that they make it more radical. When Joseph Smith brings us the forgotten traditional stories of Enoch, Abraham, and the ritualization of earlier concepts into the endowment, he does it in the context of a restoration. And that is, his teachings were indeed a restoration of ancient tradition is not the question presented here, though I believe that they were. Of importance to me at present is the discussion of the manner in which Joseph Smith may have used the contemporary symbolism portrayed in available religious traditions of the day in an entirely legitimate exercise of his prophetic mantle and in keeping with the practice of his predecessors. The function of ritual is to give form to human life, not in the way of a mere surface arrangement, but in depth. All life is structure, and in the hierarchy of living creatures, the more elaborate the structure, the higher the life form. I like to use the metaphor of the bird building a nest to represent the connection between revelation and conscious selection of appropriate religious symbols. A mother bird builds her nest of materials consciously selected from its surrounding and local environment, and yet according to an architecture which is unconsciously dictated from within. This pattern from within, whether called instinct or revelation, is something certainly real to the bird and yet at the same time unexplainable. Though one may come along later and looking at the nest and recognizing some of its components from their former place in the environment, call attention to the obvious appropriation of familiar objects in the building of the nest, one must also recognize that it is in fact now a nest and a new entity. Joseph Smith gave us very little in the form of concrete statements regarding the medium through which the temple ritual is obtained, other than to say that, quote, when these things are communicated to man, it is always on the principle of revelation. For several years, I've been interested in the similarities in the possible appropriation of elements of the Masonic ritual into our own temple ritual, and I have considered from time to time the basis for that similarity. those of us who look at connections between the symbolism of masonry and the endowment may be making a point while missing its relevance altogether. What is the role of a prophet with regard to his use of symbolism within his new dispensation? And from what well does he draw forth fresh and meaningful symbols of eternal life with which to endow his constituency? The history of the study of the prophets is not a long one. Prophecy as an independent religious phenomenon was not discovered until the 19th century, when a whole new era of the Bible was brought to light. All at once, the prophets emerged from the shadows which had obscured their real significance. The pendulum, however, swung too far in the other direction. The prophets were not as original, as personal, as immediate to God as they were then thought to be. We can now see from time to time they're dependent upon ancient traditions with which they interpret and present anew. In the first joy of discovery, the essential character of the prophet was thought to be his spiritual independence and religious immediacy. Scholars have since shown that the prophet's involvement in ancient Eastern ideas and cult and myth, indeed even in primitive magic ideas, was much greater than had been supposed. Furthermore, this involvement in the traditions and general religious ideas of their environment was by no means just a peripheral one. It extended to the center of their message. This statement begs a question. When Alexander Campbell said of the Book of Mormon, the center of Joseph Smith's message, that it contained all of the errors and most of the truths discussed in New York over the last 10 years, was he unwittingly validating Joseph's prophetic mantle? In seeking to expose Joseph Smith as a charlatan who was merely involved in the traditions and general religious ideas of his environment, Campbell has only affirmed Joseph's place in the prophetic club. It seems clear that revelations recorded in the Doctrine and Covenants, combined with other public and private teachings of the prophet, had over the years developed the foundation for the message transmitted in the endowment. So that Joseph's anxiety over the introduction of the Nauvoo endowment, accomplished shortly before his death, did not constitute an unveiling of much new theology, but an encapsulation and ritualization of his revelations over the preceding years in a symbolic form so totally familiar to his initiates that the symbols immediately became larger than life and succeeded in relating those doctrines in a manner which could be institutionalized. I believe that whatever may have been Joseph's role in the appropriation, that he was successful in the choice of symbolism. Not only, and I want to make a point here, I'm just as confused as anyone else may be on the connection between these worldly symbols or the Masonic ritual with the temple. So I'm not trying to make a point saying yes, it was part of it. I'm saying that, though, that you can slide this discussion aside and focus on the other issue. If it was, then where does that put Joseph when alongside of the other prophets? And I'm saying that it looks like that, in fact, was a part of their prophetic mantle to actually look at the playing field, to consider that. I think of President Benson's speech down at BYU a few years ago that everyone got upset about, that the prophet had the authority to have revelation or make pronouncements upon things that aren't entirely religious. But I see that as fitting in the same general mold, and that is that if to the Lord all things are spiritual, and if the prophet is his representative, then the prophet is not... you can't take the prophet and put him in a box and say, this is your playing field. And I think that Joseph Smith, in a lot of his public statements, dealt with this issue. Remember one statement where he said that, I have all the wisdom of the world and an independent revelation to boot. And you think that he was trying to make people understand that it was okay for him to go into these various areas and to come out with some new doctrine. Again, not only did Joseph Smith appropriate religious and fraternal symbols of the day, but he chartered a Masonic lodge in the city and inducted his faithful followers through its mysteries immediately before rededicating the same building for the introduction of the endowment, leaving his followers with an understanding that while the symbolic expressions used may have had connection to other religious traditions, the concepts transmitted formed a new religious tradition altogether. It was the nest which Joseph had created and not the sticks and strings with which it had been constructed. I'd like to make 4 points of the role of the prophet. The first is that a prophet always sees himself as a restorer or a reformer. Two, he links himself to the older myths, symbols, and traditions in order to establish validity to his message. Three is he and his message are equally involved in the traditions and general religious ideas of their own time and environment. And four, his revelations are often given to him in a raw form, which must be restated in the best modes of expression available in the surrounding environment, and thus to the prophet himself. And five, Joseph's continual preoccupation was in finding a way to express his revelations so that he could, quote, make the saints of God to comprehend them. Why this has been so difficult for many of us to understand is probably grounded in our own lack of familiarity with the proper function of myth and symbolism. Campbell cites four functions which should be served by a properly operating mythology. The first is, this is quoting him, the first is what I have called the mystical function, to awaken and maintain in the individual a sense of awe and gratitude in relation to the mystery dimension of the universe, so that he recognizes that he participates in it, since the mystery of being is the mystery of his own deep being as well. The second function of a living mythology is to offer an image of the universe that will be in accord with the knowledge of the time, the sciences and fields of action of the folk to whom the mythology is addressed, that Lord gives to men in their own language and their own time and these. The third function of living mythology is to validate, support, and imprint the norms of a given specific moral order, that namely in which the individual is to live. And the fourth is to guide him stage by stage in health, strength, and harmony of spirit through the whole foreseeable course of a useful life. I think those are important because I think that you can, with those general criterion, you can evaluate your ritual and see to what extent it is serving all of those purposes. The first, the mythical function, is clearly represented in the temple ritual. Not only are we shown the creation of Adam or Michael's and Michael or Adam's role in it, but we are each to consider ourselves as an Adam, acknowledging our participation in the mystery of life and our connectedness to the rest of the universe. This mystery of our duality of being is eloquently expressed through the prophet Joseph in the person of Moses, who says, "For this cause I know that man is nothing, which thing I had never supposed." And then almost immediately this rejoinder, "But now mine own eyes have beheld God, his glory was upon me, and I beheld his face, for behold, I am a son of God in the similitude of his only begotten." And so you've got this saying, I'm nothing and I am God. This powerful dual identity of man is beautifully expressed in the temple ritual and fulfills the first criterion for a living mythology. The second function, according to Campbell, was to offer an image which was in accord with the knowledge of the time. For the past several years, I've collected many early 19th century books and artifacts broadly classified as Mormon parallels. The significance of all of the items is the degree to which they establish the cultural context for Joseph Smith's revelations. Alexander Campbell's complaint was that Joseph merely incorporated all of these contemporary questions into his revelations, including both truth and error, hence the knowledge of his time. The third and fourth functions of validating and supporting the specific moral order and guiding initiates stage by stage through life also seem to be specifically fulfilled in our ritual. Joseph Smith's realization that in order to be valid, a mythology or religious system must speak to the circumstances of the group in its own time, knowledge and language is emphasized in the concept of the true and living church. This is the principle upon which heaven is governed. Do you remember that quote from Joseph Smith? It's a revelation adapted to the circumstances that men find themselves in, which is, seems to be a very pragmatic sort of approach for revelation. Old Testament prophets saw God, as did Joseph Smith, this messenger formula being best represented by the words, "Thus saith Yahweh," or "Thus saith the Lord." But according to Von Rad, the messenger formula, frequent though it is still only one among many forms used by the prophets in their preaching. In fact, they showed no hesitation in availing themselves of all manner of forms in which to clothe their message. None, secular and sacred alike, was safe from appropriation as a vessel for the discharge of his task by one prophet or another. What these men wanted to do, of course, was to attract attention. Indeed, sometimes their express intention was to shock their audience. That's end quote. While these discussions are important for Latter-day Saints, I propose that they are much easier to conduct today than they would have been in Joseph Smith's day, for the very reason stated by Von Rod concerning the prophets of earlier dispensation. That is, in order for a new prophet to establish the validity of his message and form a new group, he must appeal to the old traditions and establish his link with the past. Joseph Smith provided this link through the Book of Mormon as a voice speaking to and of him out of the dust. A revelation given through Joseph Smith in September 1832, known today as Section 84 of Doctrine and Covenants, explains a connection with the symbolism of the world and the teaching of religious truths in this way. The Spirit giveth light to every man that cometh into the world, and the Spirit enlighteneth every man through the world that hearkeneth unto the voice of the Spirit. With this revelation as a backdrop, it should be less confusing in establishing the relationship between the ideas and symbols of the world and the transcendent religious truths contained in the revelations of God. After all, the world was to be the means of enlightening every man that hearkened to the Spirit. All things have their likeness, and all things that are created and made to bear record of me, said the Lord to Adam. When Joseph Smith used the signs and symbols of Masonry, Egyptology, Catholicism, contemporary folk magic to house the eternal truths of his unformatted revelations, he clearly felt authority to do so based on the text of his own revelations, which clearly anticipated that these worldly forms were created for the very purpose of teaching these truths. Apocryphal accounts of Abraham and Jesus' own visits to Egypt, the seat of the world, suggest that a prophet must encounter and master the world and be trained in its trappings, protocol, and symbolism before he can effectively speak to the issues of the world. Thus, Jesus comprehended all things only because he descended below all things. Paul in Rome, Joseph and Moses in Egypt, and Joseph Smith in Masonry, Egyptology, and folk magic become striking examples of the prophets receiving their initiation at the hands of the very world which they will later call their people out of. To be meaningful to us today, these symbols must either continue to be relevant to the problems and ideas of our day, or else must have the power to become so. And if they're not relevant to us today, how can we go about making them so? And by the way, that was a paragraph from a couple years ago when I gave this. And my feeling and my interest in giving this paper again was that I feel that some of the things that I was talking about here in terms of the evolution of our ideas and the temple ritual as a means of sort of softening our hearts and allowing us to go forward. The question, how can we go about making them more relevant, I think speaks to what has happened, which I think shows that just a change of a couple words and emphasis can change the direction of our thinking somewhat. I agree with Joseph Campbell when he states that in a world as fast-paced and unstable as ours, it's very difficult to evolve new myths to fit our circumstances. The natural and observable result of that difficulty of getting a new myth, up-to-date current mythology, is that there's an attempt to return to more stable time in the past, a return to the old-time religion and an advance in fundamentalism. This return to the past, usually a fictionalized, romanticized past which never existed, does not represent the step forward anticipated by a belief that God has many great and important things yet to reveal. But a return to the religious fountain of our past, the symbolism housed in the temple, in an attempt to again go forward into the future with authority from our own past, will be made easier and more relevant if done with a greater understanding and in the context of our own symbolic ritual. Our church and religion have survived monumental changes both during the life of Joseph Smith and since. It is remarkable to consider that we've gone from monogamy to polygamy and back to monogamy through the United Order and the revelation on the priesthood, and have done so while not only continuing to grow, but without significantly changing the doctrines and covenants which have established us from the beginning. I believe this has only been made possible because the idea of an open canon, which has allowed for the innovation of doctrine against the backdrop of a very conservative organization. And as we go forth in the future and deal with such issues as expanding role of women in society and in the church, I believe it will be through the introduction of more appropriate symbols which will prepare the way for members and of the church to accept the changes that may yet come as the church deals with the potentially divisive issues facing us as religious culture. In fact, I believe that it will be through our most sacred ritual that the path is paved for the softening hearts and positions which will lessen the opportunity for deep schisms such as those that have occurred in the organized church where no similar foundational ritual is available to deal with such issues as women in the priesthood. The power of symbolism lies in its ability and purpose to both reveal and conceal. Mythology is the use of symbolism to construct a meaningful picture of life, which can provide us protection and nourishment as we develop and mature. Just as the baby kangaroo, unready for the external world, emerges from his mother's womb into the external protective pocket, mythology forms a similar protection, actually an organic relationship with us. It shelters while it nourishes. We may be out of the womb, but we're still babes in the woods, requiring milk before meat. Mythology, like the protection of religious and family institutions, provides us that halfway point as we emerge from our innocent state into a mature relationship with the greater environment which we're a part of. Joseph Smith used symbolism to reveal religious principles which were in some cases most dedicated followers. The positive power of symbolism is that great. But there's also the concealing aspect of symbolism. To quote Rosemary Radford Ruther, "Received symbols, formulas, and law are either authenticated or not through their ability to illuminate and interpret experience. Systems of authority try to reverse this relation and make received symbols dictate what can be experienced as well as the interpretation that is experienced." And so the symbol sometimes becomes the hammer, you know, rather than the open the window. In reality, the relation is the opposite. If a symbol does not speak authentically to the experience, it becomes dead or must be altered to provide a new meaning. Our rich heritage as a people with our unique ritual provides opportunities for great spiritual experiences if we use the myths to inform our lives and not to shut out further revelation. Carl Jung said that religion is the best defense against a religious experience. I take this to mean both that symbolism can serve to help us ignore the realities which the symbols point us to, and also to accept the symbol as a reality itself and never press beyond the surface. Greater appreciation of symbolism and mythology has enriched my life. It has opened doors to thoughts and ideas which were previously closed to me. By applying it to my own religious beliefs, it has given rise to expanded thinking and has allowed me to focus on the developing and unfolding characteristics of life while still accommodating my need for stability, and I believe that it can continue to provide the same for others. Thank you.
Apparently we have had a last-minute change. We will have a respondent. Brian Kubaras, who is an editorial assistant at Sunstone, an MFA candidate in English, specifically in fiction writing at the University of Utah, will be responding to Jeff. And hopefully we'll have a few minutes for questions and answers, but we do need to end at 9:30. So, Brian?
I wish this were donuts, but it's not. It's my computer. And I could not get to a printer, and so I'm just going to have to read this off the screen. It's going to look weird, but it's going to sound okay. So bear with me. Okay. Here we go. All right, I'm going to be basing my comments a little bit on the Marxist theory of Terry Eagleton and also on the post-structural, post-modernist theory of MTV. And we'll see how it goes. And also I'm going to be addressing myself to what Jeff said towards the end of his paper about concealment, that the role of the symbolic and culture and myth can play a role of concealment. And I also want to address the four categories that he lists in his abstract at the in the Sunstone program. He talks about some of the roles that the prophet is purveyor of symbol and ritual. Some of those roles that he can fulfill. One is the preservation and renewal of previous doctrine and religious ritual. The other, the reevaluation of existing doctrine and ritual. Three, appropriation of new symbolism. And four, appropriation of symbolism to house a new doctrine. Mm-hmm. So you'll see how I refer back to those ideas as I progress in my response, and hopefully it'll make some sense to you. Anyway, here we go. Although not exclusively, the prophetic role has been seen throughout history for the most part as a masculine role. The proliferation of male prophets in the Old Testament is one example of this. Jeff, along with other modern culture, in holding up Joseph Smith as a model man and as a model prophet, seems to fall under this same belief. However, what might we learn from another vision of what it means to be a prophet? A vision of the prophet in which the prophetic role, whether it is occupied by male or female bodies, is seen as a more feminine role. The metaphors Jeff uses to describe the workings of a prophet are predominantly masculine. The notion of preserving, reevaluating symbolism in a scientific or theological sense, and appropriating symbolism from various sources all seem to allude to a romantic or masculine expansionist tradition, whether geographical or scientific, one of conquesting territory and defending sacred grounds. The idea is that in conquesting the virgin earth or any metaphorical virgin terrain, the masculine quester, in this case a prophet, is converting the virginal, making the feminine conform to a masculine order. In an alternate reading of the prophetic tradition, it is possible to read the prophet not so much as a conquistador or crusader, but instead in the more feminine role of decorator or fashion designer. Archetypal criticism, such as the kind practiced by Joseph Campbell, sees mythology in terms of surface and depth. Religious practice and ritual have their external trappings, their decorations and costumes, their particular songs and rituals which distinguish one culture from another. But archetypal readings tend to look beyond the surface vestiges, the particularities of any specific culture, and these archetypal readings interest themselves more in finding a universal deep structure which transcends any of the particularities of the specific groups. This supposedly universal structure they call truth, nature, or the sacred. For this school of thought, opposing cultures may look different on the outside, but on the inside they're all the same. But if a similar structure does indeed exist beneath the surface of varying cultures, must that deep structure be a mandala, some natural divine pattern, or could it really be just a historically created patriarchal structure, which is not natural, but which we have been seduced into believing is natural? If that uniform pattern we find at the root of most cultures is indeed the basic structure of patriarchy, we might then consider that Jeff's metaphors of the masculine forcibly conquesting the feminine become inappropriate. It would seem that instead of devouring new ground, the role of prophet would be that of defending old ground in the form of patriarchal paradigms. This territorial defense is a seemingly masculine endeavor as long as we consider that defense to be a military one. However, this territorial defense is a seemingly masculine endeavor as long as we consider that defense to be a military one. However, military might is not the only source of defense we know. In addition to the use of tooth and nail, one other means of defense is camouflage, dressing something as what it is not, or, if you will, putting on drag. This seems to be at least one way patriarchal systems defend themselves. These essentially masculine structures disguise themselves in cultural trappings, in stories, myths, folk tales, dances, anything which will convince those living in a particular culture that masculine system is not masculine at all, but actually feminine. Because it would be intolerable for a community, especially a religious community, to identify itself as built around and out of an oppressive order. The masculine, in order to gain favor, must parade itself as the feminine and so seduce us. For this reason, in Jacques Lacan's essay, The Signification of the Phallus, he points out that the phallus can play its role only when veiled. Such being the case, the role of the prophet becomes not so much that of boldly conquesting new plunder from which to build new ritual. It is instead coyly decorating the phallus. Each time the trappings of the patriarchy become demystified to us, each time the religion we perceived as nurturing begins to sprout whiskers, it is the task of the prophet to shave the patriarchy, to find new ways of disguising it, to seduce us, to convince us that in the end the traditions we embrace do not hold us with their masculine threats, but instead with their feminine tenderness. Which is the prophet, a Christian soldier or a Madonna? In the traditional sense, and also in the sense of pop culture, this form of a Madonna. And we all recognize her, I think. The traditional Madonna is Mother of God, performed the function of making an ideal tangible, of clothing God in flesh. This, according to my alternate reading, is precisely what the prophet does when dressing the patriarchy in drag. The patriarchal structure is that ideal paradigm which the prophet renders tangible by expressing it in a body of ritual. In this type of expression, the word is made flesh. Madonna, not the religious icon, but the pop icon, seems to express herself in comparable fashion. Madonna through cross-dressing and striking traditionally masculine poses, presents herself as what she is not. She gathers bits and pieces from a variety of cultural texts and adorns herself with them to the extent that, in and on her body, the masculine appears feminine and the feminine appears masculine. The figure of the Madonna, both the traditional and the pop Madonna, despite everything we know about where babies come from and about how good girls and bad girls dress, talk, and move their bodies, both of them present themselves to us like a virgin, as that thing they cannot possibly be. And despite everything we know about them, we believe, even if it takes a miracle. A number of feminist theorists have taken great interest in Madonna because of the deconstructive possibilities she creates. They see her toying with their tradition as a possible means of redefining gender roles and escaping the patriarchy. And yet I ask myself, Madonna, despite her rebellious attitude and repeated transgression of Victorian dress and grooming standards, for whose pleasure does she present herself this way? Is Madonna's look, despite its audacity, designed to please a feminine or a masculine gaze? I would suggest the latter. Does the same apply to the patriarchy? When a potentially threatening patriarchy parades itself as feminine in order that we might desire it, is that feminized patriarchy as object of desire designed to please the woman or the man? I don't want to present at this point any final definition of what it means to be a prophet. My little paradigm, for which I am indebted to at least two critical thinkers and a pretty good professor up at the U too, is indeed only one paradigm amongst many. Yet if a possibility does exist that the spirit of prophecy is more of a veiling than an unveiling, could it be that the more truth we are given, the more we must realize the impossibility of arriving at a definitive and a unified truth? Because the truth will always be just one other story we have told ourselves. And although we needn't see this as unfortunate, that our expansionist quest for the ultimate truth, we must never arrive. Thank you.
I really like the way he turned the pages. We do have a few minutes for questions. Did you have one? Want to make one last stand, Jeff? Before we take questions.
Before we hear from Paul back there, I was trying to figure out where Brian got these ideas until when he referred to the phallus. I knew that he's been reading Paul Toscano too much. I wasn't at all prepared with this paper to set myself up as a male chauvinist, but I want to repent for my.
Well, I'm Gil Kramer.
Paul?
Well, that's the question that I have for Brian, is that I didn't hear anything before, even in the abstract that you referred to, see anything that was so heavily laden with patriarchal constructs that it would have justified, in my mind, your coming forth with what I consider to be an attack on patriarchy. But obviously, not had anything to do with just paper. Preservation, I think, is not any more masculine than a feminine. Women preserve things all the time. I spent countless hours preserving food because Margaret likes this ritual of preserving food, which I did not necessarily associate with a man, but with women. And in reevaluation, I'm probably because I'm blind to something, it just struck me as rather neutral. I didn't see that reevaluation was a patriarchal construct. Appropriation, I don't see how appropriation is the egg in the woman's body appropriates semen in order to create an embryo. I'm not sure that appropriation is, it needs to be interpreted in militaristic terms. We appropriate symbols. And even in your comments with respect to Madonna being a figure, I mean the rock and roll star being a figure who basically is there to please men's erotic desires, or to answer or be a stimulus for or response to men's erotic desire. I'm not sure that if we were to turn that around and look at Tom Cruise and say he was maybe a man that tries to appeal to the answer or respond to or stimulate female erotic desires, that either one of those sex symbols, I'm not sure how that there's enough of both of those in society that, I'm sure there's plenty of patriarchal junk in society, but I'm not sure how it connects with, I mean, I don't know, I'm not quite sure how it connects with just paper.
Okay, well, shall I respond? No.
Let me just say this. There's no way I'm going to attempt to paraphrase what Paul just said for the benefit of the tape here. So you can maybe comment on what he said.
You can at least plug Paul's new book, though.
Yes.
Okay. Is this on?
Hi.
Okay. I think what Paul was wondering was how I make this dramatic leap from what Jeff said to what I said.
I could have done that, but I...
All right. What I do is basically leap real hard, but the idea is that the patriarchy is that underlying paradigm which we find in all culture. Much of the archetypal readings, such as Joseph Campbell's or Carl Jung's, seem to celebrate the manifestation of the truth in the fact that they unlock behind all types of cultural constructs, whether it be in folk dancing, whether it be in initiation rituals from Indians or from Eskimos or from South Americans. They keep on finding the same basic quest, journey, narrative paradigm, and they assert that this is something which is natural to human nature, that it's something that one needs to inscribe oneself into if one is going to be realized in this life and find their way into the next, and so that we need to get into contact with this basic paradigm which we find everywhere. My only conclusion is that, you know, it's not a natural paradigm. It's something that we've created. If you look at the quest narrative, it's basically the man's story. Sure, there are women in it, but they're being bought, they're being sold, they're being possessed by men. They serve the same roles that we've seen women serve in traditional patriarchal culture for, you know, thousands of years. And I don't find, you know, the particular quest narrative, you know, if we can find it everywhere, that doesn't mean it's good. It just means we're finding it everywhere. And I think that's just an example of the patriarchy. When we strip all the cultural baggage away, when you take off all the dressings, all the trappings, all we're really left with is the phallus. And you know, it's not like something that I've come up with whimsically, but it's something that I do believe. Anyway, let me talk for just a second more, and then we'll get to some other people, because they've got things that are interesting to say, too. The idea is that, you know, traditionally we've seen the prophetic role as being that person which can, you know, turn the symbolic world into his playground. We find the prophet is that person which can basically find an entire world, a universe of symbols floating, you know, around through a variety of cultures, and it's a prophet's role to just pick and choose whatever he wants in order to, you know, deck out his own particular ideology. You know, that's fine. I don't believe there's anything wrong with picking and choosing. But again, we kind of select them in an appropriative way, and I think in kind of a colonializing way or paternalist way, a conquesting way, and then we begin to drape our own ideology in those little baubles, those bits of frill and frou-frou which we find, you know, decking out the other ideologies of the world, and then we try to, you know, convince ourselves that our patriarchal system is, you know, somehow different. from every other patriarchal system simply because it looks a little different. Whereas, you know, Madonna tries to look like 1930s Berlin cabaret singer, our patriarchy looks like, you know, the frontier woman. But, you know, the underlying system is pretty much the same. And so all I'm saying is that the role of the prophet, you know, whereas other people have articulated as being that person which is boldly going where, you know, no man has gone before, I think that, you know, sometimes, you know, the role of a shifting culture is the role of taking that culture into the women's dressing room. And, you know, there are those who might disagree with me, but that's where I stand.
Yeah, sir? And then.
Yeah, Jeff. I'm a little confused with the use of the word appropriation, particularly appropriation of the new symbol as opposed to the appropriation of the old, how the new doctrine.
Okay, I just have to restate this for the tape. He's confused about the term appropriation, so if Jeff, you'd explain that.
Well, I think that I understand where it may not have been appropriate choice of words, but basically what I mean by it is I was trying to define, I took a couple of statements of Joseph Smith. First of all, the one where he was always in, He was thinking, you know, of night and day, you know, more than his meat and drink, to find some means of expressing these revelations to people. And the second, that I'll deal with that. I think that where I'm coming from is that there are differences. Sometimes you find yourself in a situation, as I would say Joseph Smith was, where he had some truth to be revealed that had not been previously revealed, or at least institutionalized, you know, in this dispensation. The ideas in Nauvoo of, you know, God can become like man, can become like God, and God was once a man, and these kind of things, which were new ideas, there's nothing new under the sun, but it was new to our culture, and those ideas took new ritual, new means of symbolism, new forms of symbolism to express. I consider that to be a little different than a situation where we might find, as we found today, and I'm hesitant to say very much about our own ritual, but I think that those of you who are aware of changes, as mild as they may have been, that would be the more in the category that I would say is getting new symbols. And symbols can mean just words or phraseology too, but I'm saying in our ritual, the change of the phraseology, not to express a new doctrine, in my opinion. My reading of Joseph Smith was that he intended, with his choice of words and forms, he intended to put women in a role of having the priesthood to begin with in the temple. So I believe that some of the changes reflect new words or new symbols to try to more appropriately address the issues, because I think that the symbols, the words that had been used, have taken on different meanings in our culture and gave rise to the idea that the temple was just a means of making women subservient to men. I don't think that the ritual itself has yet gone far enough in totally eradicating that idea. And I just have a personal belief that Joseph Smith didn't intend for that idea to be expressed in the ritual. And so I think the evolution of those symbols is a proper role of the prophets, seers, and revelators in exercising their prophetic mantle of giving new symbolism. And I just say that would be different than the initial appropriation of those symbols. It was just a slight change. And I think that it has, I do think that by changing those things, we can soften the hearts of people, get them prepared for social changes within the church. And I think that's different than, like I cited, the reorganized church, where you just take a vote and then you have people not even going to conference, no one will sustain any of the leadership, and you have a real schism, because I think that they don't have an appropriate foundational ritual to disseminate. I don't know if that makes sense to you. But.
First of all,
and it looks like we've got to go, but I'll comment real quickly on that. I don't think it really matters. I think symbols are timeless anyway. And I mean, we haven't, no one's really made up any new symbols. It's just that, you know, which ones we happen to appropriate. So I don't think you need to really change the symbols necessarily as, you know, and update them. But I think that sometimes a change forces a new thinking and a new look at something. And so I think that it's important, not so important whether you're going to a 19th century symbol or whatever. I think, again, the bottom line is I think that our familiarity with the use of symbols, that they're meant to be a door, you know, a way of breaking open and looking at something rather than, you know, shutting off. I think that's the whole basics, bottom line to the paper, is that we can use symbols to dictate what we think, or we can use them to open up our minds and look at things in a different way. And I think that as long as, talking about teaching your children, as long as your children were able to see those symbols as not barriers, but doors, then I think that they could deal with it.
I don't think that we do,
no.
I'm afraid our time is up. Thank you very much.